Yes, it is. And Academy Award nominations came out this week, and we're not remotely interested in that, so we're not going to discuss it this week. But we are going to talk about...
it's appropriate.
What?
That they're out this week, because we're why we're here.
True, yes.
What the group is here for.
We also are here to talk about the best films of 2015, and because we have a big group, we're going to get right into it. But first, of course... Welcome to Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema. My name's Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap and film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
I'm Dave White. I'm sharing a microphone with Alonzo Duraldi. I'm not happy about that.
No, deal with it. Anyway, yeah. Joining us again this year, I think it's y'all are sort of becoming our traditional year in review panel. We're delighted to have with us... starting at my left from the New York Times, Manola Dargis is here.
Oh. Oh, nice.
The new queen of Twitter.
That's right.
Oh, yes.
The day you got on Twitter, I was like, did someone set up a fake account for Manola?
No, I have so many fake Manola Dargis accounts that I made a long time ago. I have to hedge against real fake Manola Dargis accounts.
And the minute someone started fighting with you, I was like, oh, it's a real account.
Oh, that's
it's,
her.
It's really Manola. Like, and here's the thing I love the most about your Twitter account. Just posting ads of old-timey movie stars selling soap and things. That is just, it's the best. So thank you very much for joining Twitter.
happy to be here.
Also joining us today, friend of the show, frequent guest, and from the Los Angeles Times, and you sometimes see him with me on What the Flick, Robert Abele is here.
Woo! Woo!
And hello. And all the way from Europe, France.
France. Europia?
You, yes.
Europea?
Yes. Usually joining me on my very rare podcast from abroad, but from Variety, Peter de Bruges. Welcome.
Woo! Okay, I'm going to make this easier for you.
Okay.
So you don't have to crane your neck all the way around.
Uh-huh.
What will be comfortable most for you?
I'm fine.
Like that?
This,
you're like
this
that?
This pivots. It's good. Right. It's, no, okay. It's fine. It's fine. All right, well, before we get into autopsying 2015, I feel like we have to talk about David Bowie and Alan Rickman, who we lost this week, both of, at the age of 69, both of cancer, weirdly enough. And I was thinking about it. I mean, Bowie is kind of more of a screen presence than an actor, but that's in itself hard to accomplish. Like, you know, I think Prince wishes he were that kind of presence when he was sort of making a stab at being a movie star. And
don't you knock Prince.
Prince is awesome, but you know what I'm saying.
Bowie was like somebody who kind of flitted between media and kind of like, it just, you know, that's why his movie life is very, has that feeling to it. It wasn't, you never sensed that he was trying to be trying to conquer a medium. He mm-hmm. just, he thought, if I did this, I will... Be good at it.
Did he flit?
Bowie, yes.
It would be interesting.
Did he flit or did he glide like an elegant space bird?
I think he cascaded.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just I found myself thinking about just the very mixed bag of interesting work he did from Man of Fell to Earth, The Hunger, you know, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. I feel like one of the few defenders of Absolute Beginners, but I really
you
like
are.
I like him in that movie. There's a lot of in that film that doesn't work, but I think his scenes are great.
Yeah, exactly. There's an image of him you have in the movie that seems to transcend the fact that the movie is not good.
Yeah. And then Alan Rickman, who, you know, I think is one of those sort of like utility players that we tend not to dote upon or, you know, like shower with awards or whatever, and then he's gone, and you're like, oh yeah, Alan Rickman, he was great.
I,
think that's a bigger surprise. Just, I mean, yeah. I didn't have a very clear concept of his age, and, you know, it's
I didn't, yeah, 69 seemed like, I didn't
too old.
Think, it seemed like he was told.
Well, he was 41 when he was cast in Die Hard, apparently.
Yeah.
So he,
I guess
you
that
know.
Makes sense, but there's some way that he didn't seem to have aged since Die Hard in my head.
It was that black wig he was wearing.
Seriously, I think when you're in a franchise, and it's supposed to kind of, like, even the kids get older, but the adults not really, it does actually give you a way of never really aging on screen. So
I think the thing that was interesting, I mean, I've loved, I think we've all loved Alan Rickman for a very long time. But what was so interesting about his work as Snape in the Harry Potter movies is that he was kind of the perfect example of someone who goes into a kind of an industrial machine and makes it actually something that means something to you and has a kind of a personal resonance. The personal touch is there. And I mean, I had read the books, you know, very quickly, but somehow this Snape in the movies was such a more profound character for me and meant so much. And the transformation of when you see actually what's going on with Snape, and it was just really beautiful, beautiful work. And I'm just so interested in, because we live in an age of blockbusters, that someone can come in
and put a stamp on something,
and do
yeah.
this incredible filigreed work, you know, in what is fundamentally this huge machine.
At the eighth movie, you're, you know, when you have the scenes that he had to do in the last movie, you're supposed to be moved to tears, and you are by his performance and it makes sense. And I love the story that when you made the first one, he was really kind of like wondering, you know, he was a little bit wondering, why am I playing this basically this kind of like this dark, grim, you know, insulting kind of guy. J.K. Rowling actually took him aside and told him, nobody else on the movie knew this. They told him what the plan was for Snape. Mm-hmm. And he thought, I can hang around with this. Right. I mean, I don't think even like maybe Chris Columbus knew, like when he was making those movies, like where certain characters were going all the way. So I love that story. That's
well, it's
fantastic.
Clear that like none of the other, I mean, I think the reason of those Harry Potter movies, the reason the third one is a book and is a movie I love so much is it's the one where it pays off things that you didn't realize were being set up earlier on.
Right.
And he's the character, he's the actor in that whole ensemble that does exactly what you're saying. You know, it's like everyone else has been there for the journey. A couple people got replaced, I guess, along the way for...
They died.
some are movie only characters. You know,
But, I mean, it's like, no, it's clear that and he's been doing this, I love your sort of, you know, filigreed description. There's a layer of nuance there that he's building in all along, knowing that character's gonna like have these other layers that emerge,
but he doesn't tip it off, which is so nice. It's so funny that he knew that, but you don't feel in the performance that he's kind of like winking at us and saying, you know,
no. And even though they give you flashbacks in the last movie, all of a sudden you do look at those scenes differently. Even when he's just saying some sort of like insulting thing to Harry Potter, you can tell what's behind it now, and you can see it in the flashback, and which means he was doing it. You know,
it doesn't undo the earlier performances, but it just sort of enriches them. I did not see either of the films that he directed. I don't know if you guys did. He did a movie a few years ago called The Winter Guest with Emma Thompson and Phyllida Law, and then this past year, A Little Chaos.
I did not see that one.
But I did not see them, so I didn't.
You know, the thing that struck me as weird on the event of his death is seeing on TV, I don't know which network it was, but basically the news that Alan Rickman had died was accompanied by the clip of him falling to his death in Die Hard.
Oh,
yes.
What?
Is
that's
that
seriously?
It's awful. The conflation is just awful. Yeah.
Although, interesting story about that scene, apparently McTiernan dropped him a second early. Like, there was supposed to be a countdown, and, like, he dropped him early, and that's why he's got that look on his face, like, yeah! And he was not pleased.
But
acknowledged that, you know.
The fact that he actually even did the stunt was pretty amazing.
True, yeah. I mean, again, if it's a practical, like, him falling, like, 40 feet into a, you know, pad or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. all right, so, speaking of practical stunts, 2015, you know, I knew when I saw Mad Max that it was amazing, and I didn't realize that it was going to carry me all year, that it was going to be the movie that in December I was still like, yeah, Mad Max, like, you know, and I think a lot of it has to do with, I remember when the glut of CG started, this notion of somebody at some point is going to go back and do it old school, and we're all going to lose our minds because we've forgotten what that looks like. Am I alone here? Did you guys? Was this a movie that kind of carried you through the year as well?
I was. It carried me through the year, and then I remember going the second time I went to go see it, which was months after I saw it for the first time, and I thought, well, here's the real test. I'm seeing it for the second time. I'm going to see it in 3D because I didn't see it in 3D the first time, and was still blown away. And then watched it a third time at home on DVD, and was still blown away. So it's the only thing I've seen three times.
In different formats and video.
Different formats.
Yeah.
You'd
be watching it on your little
the black and white one. I'll watch the black and white one on my wristwatch.
That and The Assassin are the only two things I saw twice.
The two best movies.
Yeah, the two best movies.
Yeah.
Peter, did you see it at Cannes?
Mad Max I saw there, and I haven't rewatched it since. I mean, I was entertained, but I didn't understand. They like drive out to the middle of the desert to do something that can't be done, and then you drive back, and that's the story.
Sorry. Are we talking about logic in the Mad Max movie?
No, okay. No, look, she's driving them back to where she came from, discovers that where she came from no longer exists, and the new strategies to go back and take the Citadel before the rest of them can get back there.
To not think about escaping to something in the past, but to be going forward and by taking over something and making it your own.
I don't think I was engaged with the material. I think I was impressed by the style and the technique. You know, it's like, it feels light years ahead of, and the fact that it's so much of it's practical and that he's just got cameras everywhere and that they're sort of cutting it together in a way that's dynamic, but always, like, you know, logical, which is not something that I've seen in much of recent action cinema. But it's like, but I just sort of wasn't invested in the story.
I was pretty sure I'd just seen the greatest movie ever made when I saw it. I was just so dizzy with happiness, you know. And then I saw The Assassin, and I was very, you know, thrilled by that as well. And I think they're very similar, you know. I think there's some kind of, you know, they're purely cinematic, you know.
They're gasp movies.
It was one of the interesting things. I don't know how deep we want to go down this rabbit hole, but I think it's interesting that Mad Max is such, I think, glorious movie, and it's a sequel, and it's part of a franchise, and it's a great movie. You know, it's not, even if you don't think it's great, it's still, you think it's a good movie, and that kind of goes against the grain of the kind of idea of like, oh, we're done, you know, sequels are horrible, franchises are horrible, and actually, here's someone who just the filmmaking is so fantastic. I mean, it's just brilliant that it kind of tests that argument that sequels and franchises are worthless and they're ruining cinema. You know
I mean, I think I had to sort of maybe disabuse myself of that point of view as a variety critic, because it's, I mean, just as what you're doing is reviewing for the industry, industrial cinema by and large. And what's also interesting is since I've 2 years ago gone abroad to Europe, that's not my diet anymore. My diet is now the kind of, which is also our readership at Variety. It's another part of the industry that's not necessarily commercially facing, certainly not French cinema. You know, it's like a lot of that's very kind of individualistic and, you know, auteur cinema and stuff like that.
The Asterix movies especially.
No, I mean, the French industry makes garbage just as well.
We've seen that.
It's like and those movies, by and large, don't, you know, import here.
Right.
You know? And it's like
Taxi 3, 4.
I mean, we force feed them our garbage,
you
and
know
we have
how
no
bad
interest.
It is.
On a week in, week out basis, you know, it's like. But that said, I mean, it's like if you're reviewing for a trade, you can't kind of go in with that assumption that, like, God, like, if they spend a lot of money on something, it's just going to be dumb or whatever. And it's like the. I think it's refreshing to hear, you know, someone coming around by movies that are proving to you the Harry Potter franchise toward the end, you know, the Mad Max movies. Certainly, I think some of the Pixar sequels have, you know, kind of done that Godfather thing of, like, doubling down and improving on, or, you know, going deeper than, and it's like...
I know Robert wasn't a fan, but I would put Creed in that category. I thought that really kind of rebooted the Rocky movies in a way that reminded me of what made the first couple of Rockies so satisfying. You know, it, albeit hitting a lot of the same beats, but I mean,
Creed needed to be made. I mean, Creed needed to be made. If you were to continue that franchise, that's the movie you have to make.
Yeah. And also, I having just watched Rocky, I mean, Creed is a better directed movie. It just is. I'm sorry.
Wow. Okay.
It just is. It's just, I can't even put them, I mean, what's interesting, and I know we didn't want to talk about the Oscars, but it's, you know, we're talking about these movies that are, you know, being released by big studios or, you know, studio movies, industrial cinema, and yet we all are giving them praise, and that seemed to be one of the stories of 2015. We're like, oh, wait, that doesn't suck. That's
right.
Actually good.
They don't have to be terrible.
And yet it feels like the Academy is still kind of stuck in that quality with a capital Q mode, you know, where it has to be, you know, that you can't actually, you know, celebrate or honor. And yes, of course, Mad Max did get a nomination. In some ways, I think the Mad Max movie is almost like there's no denying that movie.
Yes.
But George Miller already had cachet as a great filmmaker.
Sure. But in other instances, movies that we're talking about did not somehow. And I think that you can actually, like, why is Inside Out, which I think is like a masterpiece, honestly.
Yeah,
is that not a best picture?
Why is that not a best picture?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, that just seems to me about, like, oh, it's an animation. Like, we're back to that kind of thing.
Well, and there now are precedents for Pixar movies getting in there.
Of course.
It's like the,
after the expansion, yeah.
Right, after the expansion.
Well, and I mean, this past year, I mean, I love the Star Wars movie in a way that brought me back to the reason that I love movies at all. You know, it's like, it's almost like I regressed. And I think what you experienced in Mad Max is that thing that, like, a big blockbuster movie fires on the cylinders that your aesthetics are now. You know, it's like it's risen to that level. Whereas I somehow, maybe to do my job, I always do that thing. I joke with my friends about, like, I can channel my 13-year-old girl who likes the Hannah Montana concert, not likes, but would be the target audience. Like, what does she think? Or the grandma who would respond to a movie like Grandma.
You can see multitudes.
And it's like Star Wars, it's like you have to be a little like, schizophrenic, I think, you know, when you're kind of like doing the job of reviewing for, like, who is the audience for this movie and what would they think, which is slightly a different job from kind of like, I am my audience and what do I think? You know, it's a weird kind of balance that you juggle there.
Well, when I talked about Mad Max on What the Flick, when we did our best films of the year, I said that it was that Anton Ego moment, you know, where you take a bite and just you're flooded with, you know, all the reasons why you ever cared about this stuff or why it ever meant anything to you. And yeah, Mad Max just kind of pressed all those buttons for me. And it's not like I'm Mr. Adrenaline Cinema guy, you know, but just the craft of it and the beauty of it and the visual coherence, like you were saying, like that you can have a movie with this many moving parts and this many, like, quick cuts, and at the same time completely understand what's happening, where people are in relation to each other, how does this service the story, the narrative as it moves forward, and just be exciting and visually, you know, thrilling and all that stuff at the same time. Yeah, it's those jolts of pleasure, and whether they're tapping into, you know, the 8-year-old you, like, at a matinee, or the college you seeing, you know, 8 and a half for the first time. I mean, like, there's all those sort of different facets that we bring to this job and the kinds of movies that we like. And, you know, like, Manola is a Star Trek fan, you know, and she also loves Hu Xiaoxian, you know. I mean, like, that we all have those different, you know, envelopes waiting to be filled at these movies.
I think it's kind of exciting when something jumps into, like, it puts you in a category that you didn't think, if you aren't normally the action cinema guy. I mean, for me, what you're describing, the reaction you guys are describing with Dreamgirls a number of years back, where I just don't get musicals. I don't really like them normally. I mean, it's like I find them... my understanding of them was often that there's story, and then you hit a wall, and then they do a song, and then there's more story, and it's like... And Dreamgirls was a movie that cinematically kind of made me get it, and the music became the media, the sort of like the thread that allowed you to kind of like, because there it's just driving the movie forward through decades and through, you know, all these different locations, and it's like, and I loved the cinematography and the cutting and the just the sort of pageantry of it all there, and so I get the reaction you're saying. I just happened to maybe, you know, where it landed that day, but well, I kind of don't think if I went back to Mad Max I'd have it. Terribly different reaction.
The thing that struck me the second time I saw Mad Max was I was this idea that there's not every single shot in that movie. I mean, we're talking in the action sequences means something, tells you something that you need to know to understand what happened before and to get what's going to happen next. There's no, he did not make that movie with, you know, here's 8 cameras, I'll edit it later. I mean, he knew exactly when he turned on the camera, it was to show, and then put it in the movie, it was to show you something. And I think that and The Assassin were the movies that you just, every single shot was important to that movie. And I think movies have been getting away with that for so long with shaky cam, you know, the whole, you know, eight cameras on something at once and editing it later. And I think, you know, these directors are letting you know that, yeah, when you think about things, you make beautiful, fantastic movies.
Just a quick program note. Dave and I will talk about 13 Hours on a later program.
We will. We're not going to do this. All right, we'll do it next week.
Right, exactly. But also, I mean, we're also talking about a certain level of just virtuosity, you know, that someone actually knows. I mean, what's shocking me sometimes is just how badly made movies are sometimes, that, you know, in terms of they just look terrible, or they didn't bother to, like, try to have a good, you know, the finished product, they didn't bother to, like, spend any money on it, you know.
There's an Oscar-nominated Best Picture that I would put that
in. Yeah. Oh, do tell. No, you don't want to?
Oh, no, I would say, I don't think Room is a well-made movie.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, because y'all are among the small pool of people that agree with me that this is, the performances are fine, but the movie is just.
There's a certain level of ambition in the first hour. You know, I think
that
there's absolutely a level of ambition in terms of how you shoot into a very, very small space. You know, so I kind of thought, but I, you know, if you actually watch, and this gets a whole question about watching stuff on your television or watching with worse links, you know. That if you actually watch certain movies, you can actually see, like, what the actual the image quality is. You know, I found the image quality was not very good in Room. I thought they looked really thin to me, and I don't think it was a function of where I saw it. It just didn't look good. They were shooting with this kind of, for me, it looked like substandard, you know,
digital.
And I don't mind, you know, if it's someone like Soderbergh or Fincher, you know, they can make digital work for me. But,
or Michael Mann.
Or Michael Mann, of course. But this just looked really thin, didn't look really good. And then when we get to the second hour, where it's like turns into a dreary, you know, cable of the week show. Oh my God, I just couldn't believe it. So what's the deal?
I could see, like, I know several filmmakers who
terribly
who
directed well, second hour.
Right, but I know several filmmakers who told me that they really wanted to adapt that book. And I could see where, like, it was a big book, and as an object of, like, how do I tell this story cinematically. I could see the desire to want to do that, and now that would be this sort of, like, you know, obstruction, to borrow from Lars von Trier. Like, you know, how do I make this thing work? And maybe somebody could, but I don't know that this director, the Academy Award nominated Lenny Abramson, was the person to do it.
It almost feels like he hasn't embraced that obstruction necessarily. You know, it's like the, I mean, because he hasn't really kind of, obviously he's forced to sort of direct that first half in the room, but it's not like he's really kind of like being inventive with that choice, and maybe that's deliberate too, to sort of like get out of the, what was the Buried, the movie, you know, that where it's like then you're just constantly aware of how they're shooting everything in a coffin.
I think he's trying to be inventive. I just don't think it's all that interesting, but I think he is trying in terms of just showing like what the child sees, that kind of the radical subjectivity of the little boy,
right? Like, you have to make it banal because the person through whose eyes you're watching doesn't understand that this is unusual.
It's a bubble boy. His like his entire experience is in that room with his mother and the little bit of TV that they get to watch. Right. You know, it's very, it's okay for a while. I mean, it also makes the movie much more palatable, because if this were being, of course, told through the woman's point of view, it would be unwatchable.
Oh God!
Because she's being raped every day.
It would be.
You ever see that?
It would be. It would be Michael. Did you see that movie?
Oh yeah.
Right. The you know, which I liked, but was also an endurance test, and very few people saw it.
Michael.
It's directed by a protege of Hanukkah's.
It's under the sign of Hanukkah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's. I think the movie's very, very interesting, but I think that the material, the themes, the performances are the strength of it, and I'm not sure that at the end of the day that. Like, as much as I like it, clearly more than others around the table, like, I'm not sure it rises up to that kind of level of greatness that even it deserves based on, you know, kind of like where you could go with what they gave you there. You know, it becomes very melodramatic and very traditional, I think, after having...
So my question is, having triumphantly quit my job this year at Movies.com, do I have to watch Room... at all, ever, just out of curiosity's sake,
only,
or only can I do what I did immediately after quitting Movies.com and just go to LACMA on Tuesday afternoon to see another Ida Lupino movie.
Oh my god.
Because that was great.
Unless you really feel like you have to be, like if someone's going to make you be an Oscar pundit at some point in the next few weeks.
They ain't.
One of your radio gigs or whatever.
Well, actually he will.
Then that might be the one reason.
Dang it.
Like I was actually, right. I had not gotten around to Love and Mercy and I was like, oh, I'm going to have to watch it when the nominations come out. I was like, nope, no I don't.
No, but listen, even, like shortcomings aside, I do think Room is one of the more special and interesting movies of the year, just in terms of like if your taste sort of veers toward the things that are kind of non-standard, non-template, not the same movie that you don't know the movie you're going to get when you go in. Then
all right,
you know, then it's
worth. And they are going to ask me about it on the radio. So
yeah.
Let's talk about. I want to talk about Todd Haynes because.
What do you think?
Well, I and specifically,
he's got this new film coming out this week. It's called Monkey Up. It's about a talking monkey. That's a real movie, by the way. It's opening this week.
Specifically, I want to talk about Todd Haynes in regard to Quentin Tarantino because I think they both have a real interest. I think they both have a real interest in classic Hollywood styles and tropes and are not above direct references. Mm-hmm. But somehow, when Todd Haynes does it, I feel like it's in the service of a larger message and an interesting sort of point of view about societal roles, about gender, and you know all these other things. And the Tarantino's just sort of doing it because he likes it.
Todd Haynes is doing it in the service of characters he cares about and wants to see, like, you know, exploring things, and Tarantino is just like... like playing whack-a-mole with, you know, like a 12-year-old.
No. Both of them.
Somebody's uttered the word no. I was waiting to have one. Peter didn't just say it once. He said it three times. No.
Both of them are making movies that I think are designed almost to be studied. It's like they're very self-conscious and there are no kind of accidental choices. And I feel like, I mean, I think Todd Haynes comes from a very academic background. And I think Tarantino is... entire career has been met with this level of scrutiny, so they both know that kind of like their choices matter. But for me, like Todd Haynes is kind of like doing, I don't know, it's almost like covers, you know, it's like, I think Tarantino is doing kind of like the rap thing of sampling and remixing and coming up with these very unexpected kind of like, you know, recombinations. And so you can get very contemporary things in a period piece, and you can get strangely out of time things and what feels like a movie that's kind of ahead of its time. It always takes me a little bit, always takes the world a little bit of time, I think, to catch up with what Tarantino's doing.
I don't see Todd Haynes as an academic or even, I mean, you know, he studied semiotics in college. You know, I think we have all read a certain amount of theory along the way, for better or worse. I think that, and I don't think, for me, he's doing much more than doing covers. You know, I think that he is investigating cinema. I mean, he's an intellectual for sure, and you talk to him, he is, but I think that what I find really interesting about his work is that you're aware of the ideas, but that he's also really engaging emotions. I mean, I find all of his movies very deeply emotionally moving.
Sure.
In a very interesting way, very much like the way Cirque did, you know, mm-hmm. the way that Cirque does, where there's a kind of coolness for a lot of the movie, a kind of, you know, reserve that's there, whether you want to call it directing or not is, you know, whatever... your mileage.
Plus your bone.
Right. But I think that, you know, that Haynes is doing something kind of similar and that he's really kind of playing with ideas, but he's also really interested in emotions and emotions and old-fashioned melodrama. And why I think he's really interested in melodrama is because of that play, and he's working with ideas, but also emotion.
Well, and I think also historically melodrama was sort of the one place that women's stories and women's emotions
right.
were given validity in
yes.
in cinema, you know? And so, like, for me, for example, you got the opening scene of Carol, which is very clearly patterned on the opening scene of Brief Encounter. But I don't... and for a second I go, oh, wow, he's doing Brief Encounter. But then But then once I'm past that, it's about that moment and those characters. And there's, yeah, for me, a certain thrill in restaging the sort of classic heterosexual romance moment as a scene for two women. Mm-hmm. But then I think, I don't know, at some point it's not about, it doesn't feel like baggage. Whereas in Tarantino, when I recognize something, I just feel like I'm supposed to recognize that.
I just say, you know, I think a lot, we have to think about, you know, I think that the history of cinema to a degree can be also seen as a history of filmmakers talking to other filmmakers. You know, Orson Welles, what did he do? He watched...
Caligari, right?
No, it was actually John Ford.
Stagecoach, yes.
Stagecoach. He watched Stagecoach like 40 times. You know, watching it in those days didn't mean putting in a DVD. He ran it 40 times and watched it. You know, you look at Martin Scorsese, you know, in the sense of about that, that is a lot of, in a lot of ways, a dialogue with earlier directors. I would say all of the movie brats to a degree really having that. And so I think a lot of times, you know, generationally, you have different people having kind of conversations with, you know, favorite filmmakers, but also like the history of cinema itself. And I think that, you know, I think it's really smart to put Haynes and Tarantino together because I think they are both very directly engaged with the history of cinema and then trying to, like, in a way, how do you make your own movie when so many great movies have been made before, right? That's like the great kind of, I think, great burden. You know, it's like, it's the anxiety of influence problem. You know, everyone has made masterpieces. How can I do this? And Tarantino has a kind of riffing thing that he does.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But they're both kind of, you know, working with pastiche to a degree, but then breaking through, you know, sometimes more successfully than not. But I think that that's interesting.
They're interesting. The pair brings out these interesting contrasts. In a way, I think, I don't know Haynes' attitude well enough personally, but I would put him in this category of, like, there's a modesty there, where it's almost like a certain filmmaker will recognize, like, I'm confronted with this scene in the script. I don't know the solution, and the best one I know has been done before, and how, like, I'm going to borrow from that. And it's not necessarily a wink. It's almost kind of like an, you know, it's just the, it worked there. I'm recreating it. It's a loving homage. And
well, but when he does, like, the Citizen Kane through the roof moment in Velvet Goldmine, that's a,
well, there are clear
that's an homage.
Right,
I mean,
right, pieces that are meant to be picked up, but it's like the, and I don't think, But Tarantino's doing something different where there's no modesty involved. And it's kind of like, what I'm going to do is the best version of... And he takes all these crap movies and he lifts out these kind of, like, gems. And he kind of, like, combines them. So he'll have the best car chase of all time and Death Proof. You know, it's like... And he'll try and kind of, like, he wants the... His acceptance speech at the Golden Globes was kind of like, I've got the best, you know, Ennio Morricone score, which it isn't, but it's like it's finally been recognized. It's like he wants to kind of... It's part of this pride and, you know, ego that's part of his personality.
I kind of feel like... Sorry,
now we're talking about attitude rather than, you know, what's actually just on the screen. I mean, I think that Haynes is much more modest, but I think that the filmmaking is more restrained. You know, he has a different kind of approach to the material.
Sure.
You know, I mean, versus the kind of swagger that Tarantino is very much about, you know, look at me, look what I did, you know?
I've always said that I think that that in an earlier era, Tarantino would have been like the guy who edited That's Entertainment. You know, like, instead of just remaking all these sequences, he would have just found all those sequences and just jammed them together and been like, look at the scene, look at the scene, look at the scene, you know?
That, oh shoot, what's his name? Joe Dante did, you know, that sort of like, 3 6-hour kind of like cliparama.
Oh, I've never seen that.
The Movie Orgy is this thing that Dante did back. They've shown it at the New Beverly before.
Oh, wow.
It's basically what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's back when he was doing trailers for the, you know, Corman movies or whatever.
Oh, okay.
He put together this ultimate, you know, pre-YouTube. If ever it rolls around, it's worth catching.
Well, and a screenwriter, I'm sorry.
No, just echoing what everyone's already said, but like when I watch a Tarantino film, I feel like there's a fist pumping quality to what's happening, and that makes me extremely happy. I can't say I've ever seen a film of his that I didn't at least enjoy. And when I watch Todd Haynes films, and I'll go back to a Todd Haynes film again, and see it as many times as I feel like I should, and. And when I see a Todd Haynes film, I feel like he has come to me personally and said, okay, I'm going to tell you some things about life right now.
Oh.
And you, and this is about your life as well. From Superstar and the, what I feel is like the direct connection from Superstar to Velvet Goldmine, which is a deep, deep sadness. And Dottie Gets Spanked, which is, I saw Dottie Gets Spanked in the 90s when I was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a short film, and I've seen it like 7 times. And every time I see it, it just like shakes me inside because that little boy in that film is me. And there's that moment in Velvet Goldmine where Christian Bale is pointing at the Bowie creation on the screen and jumping up and down and saying to his mother, "That's me! That's me!" And so when I watch Todd Haynes films, I feel like someone is speaking very quietly to me about life. And I don't want to pump my fists. I just want to keep watching it and see it again so I can think more about it. And I live with his films in a way that I don't live with Tarantino's films. Tarantino's films are just fun at a matinee, and I have a lot of candy.
It's a demolition derby.
And and I believe there's great artistry going on with him, but it's a different, it moves me in a different way. And I'm always moved by Todd Haynes' films. Even when people say they're cold, I've heard so many people say to me, "Oh, Carol just left me cold. It was so chilly." And when I hear that person say that, it's not just one person, it's been like five or six. I just think, when did we become friends? And who are you talking to?
Who even are you?
Yeah. That's all. I like to let the guests talk. So talk, guests.
I think that in a way he's trying. I think if we are going to make a talk about a difference, is the one is really in a movie world and one is actually trying to kind of bridge movies and life. Well,
I think one is exterior and one is interior. And yeah, that's how I feel about it.
Carol, yeah. Todd Haynes is exploring as much silence as he possibly can and telling the story with looks and textures and decor and where the camera is. And Hateful Eight is Tarantino at his most, like, literally text-driven, not visual at all. I mean, like, it is the least visually interesting movie he's ever made. And it's the most talking movie he's ever made, and he's clearly heading in this direction where, you know, the words and what people are saying and just turning the camera on.
Almost like a Norman Mailer movie. It's, you know, those are like just the guys in a room talking to each other and occasionally shooting each other. But when I reviewed Hateful Eight, I talked about it sort of almost being this art prank because this is a movie that's his most dialogue heavy, and at the same time it's super ultra Panavision 70 to be inside of a room. And when I pointed that out, a screenwriter who I know on Facebook, Todd Alcott, said all of Tarantino's movies are art pranks in a way. Like, for all of his talk about kung fu and, you know, blaxploitation, whatever, his main mentor, I think, has been Godard all this time. Yeah. That he's making these movies that are sort of...
Except for the intellectual part, but yeah.
Well, but, you know, at least...
Which is why it's so funny that Jackie Brown, the movie that isn't the art prank, is one of his better movies.
Yeah, but it's interesting how, like...
Actually his best.
I think sometimes in artistry you get this kind of intuitive thing comes out, and it's interesting to me that, like, Carol is a movie about, you know, the tragedy of an impossible lesbian relationship in that era, but without a
bummer ending.
It's not a tragedy. I mean, like, in the book, you read the book, and it's like that's an ending where they're like, they're gonna make that thing work.
But I mean, like, they're an exception, and the movie is kind of recognizing, and there are different notes that it can hit with the distance of time, but the theme, I think, is there on the surface. And I think, like, it's interesting how in the last couple of movies Tarantino's done, the, like, race is bubbled up, Django is obviously
or spilled
about,
right over,
you know, but it's like and obviously it's very much on the surface to it, but I mean, I think that there are things that he's doing deliberately, and there are things that are just kind of, they just come with Tarantino's energy and his approach, and they make it more complex, and I'm not sure how, you know, kind of how intellectualized it is, but in some ways that is almost more interesting to me to untangle when it's kind of ambiguous on the side of the artist, you know, as opposed to when a movie has certain things that it wants to get across, and our job is to pick up those messages.
I mean, I think Tarantino makes movies for, you know, people who like the bleeding obvious, basically, because it's like whatever he makes it, like, ever, any point that's ever made in a movie of his, anything he wants, he dwells on it so intensely. I mean, that you're not supposed to miss it, and he's going to tell you you can't miss it. He's going to have somebody talk about it over and over again. He's going to, you know, and now he narrates his own movie, throws himself in to explain what's going to happen. He shows you things. He doesn't want you to miss anything, and so there's no, you don't get to discover a movie with a Tarantino movie. There's no sense of discovery. He just wants it all laid out for you.
Well, for example, like, you know, I cited the Brief Encounter example as, like, you know, you might recognize it or you might not recognize it, but the moment itself still works. Mm-hmm. Then you've got, say, Inglourious Basterds, where, like, we're burning down a theater, and so now we're going to have David Bowie singing about fire in a song that was originally recorded for the 1981 remake of Cat People. And it's sort of like, I see what you did there. And, you know, like, okay, it's A, it's an anachronism, B, it's about fire, and C, it's a song from another movie, which is the only reason that he knows it in the first place.
Right.
And then what do you do with that, you know?
I love that you just said that as somewhat accusatory.
No, look, I say that in full, like, I know him that about sitting, him because it's me.
Behind you is a wall of cassettes. And in the kitchen, there is a cassette player that we use for our theme music. And while we were washing dishes, we played the cassettes. And he made, half of them are mixtapes that he made for himself or friends back in the day. And there'll be a song on a tape, and it'll be by a band that I know of-ish, maybe. And I'll say, I know who this artist is, but I've never heard this song. And he'll say, oh, it was from... You know, the soundtrack to Real Genius. You know,
when
I grew up in the 80s, when the soundtrack became
right,
the soundtrack became more important to the studio than the movie.
What I've learned is that if there's a song he knows, often it came from a film.
No. I believe me, when I say that about Tarantino, three fingers are pointing back at me. Like, that's why I get to bust him on that. Because, like, I remember some interview where they talked, like, it was this fawning anecdote about how there was some discussion about the song Street Life and nobody could remember who sang it. And he goes, and Tarantino's like, oh, it was Randy Crawford. It was from the soundtrack of Sharky's Machine. And yeah. I'm like, I know that also, and I know it for the same reason you do. Oh my God, Tarantino, get out of my head. You know, so I'm not excusing it, but I totally get that that's where that's coming from. But this is why I'm not a filmmaker, you know.
Dave, I loved what you said about Todd Haynes, and there are filmmakers that do that for me more than he does. But the thing that you said about the coldness, I think, is interesting too, because there's also like the Carter Burwell effect, you mm-hmm. know, in this movie and in other movies this year, and Anomalisa, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's like, and in general, you know, it's like he. My favorite movie of all time, Fargo, has a Carter Burwell score that I adore, and there are many. But it's like he kind of brings things down, even if he puts you on that kind of resonance where you're also capable of picking up subtext and emotionally connecting with things, and it's kind of melancholy. But it's like, I wonder how much, you know, of that effect that people are taking from that movie. I mean, it's a lovely score, but it's also, you know, it's one that kind of also hits this register that's a little bit against
Think people are just want everything delivered on a plate, and maybe that's why they like Tarantino. I don't know. You know, it's just like, I think that Haynes is not explaining. I feel like it's not, there are the silences. I do feel like it's just, what people think is cold is that someone's not filling every one of those silences with a gush. With explanation, with like, oh my God, I'm so in love with her. She's amazing.
It's not a Nicholas Sparks movie.
Yeah, exactly. It's not.
And Alonzo and I have had this conversation many times on the podcast over the past.
I hate the cold thing. It makes me
years.
Insane.
Is that the idea that
there could be silence?
Actually be silence in a film, and I'm hearing less and less and less and less and less of it all the time. And when I do get a film that gives me room to be quiet for a minute, and I feel like I'm being like nourished somehow finally after not, and which is one of the things about The Assassin year. I've had a wonderful year taking unsuspecting friends to Hou Hsiao-hsien films.
Wow.
I have done this with three people.
Are you guys still friends?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Was
Gary
one of them?
Gary was the best of the lot.
He
sits there. We go see The Assassin, and he leans. I'm seeing it for the second time, and he leans into me halfway through the film, and he says, "This is the quietest movie I've ever seen in my entire life. Also, I have no idea what's going on. It's tearing me apart." When it was over, I said, are you okay? Like, are you angry? And he's like, no. He said it was really beautiful. He goes, I still don't know what happened. He said, but it was really beautiful. And so what I love about that is that, and that was the reaction of, I took another friend to see Good Men, Good Women, because The Hammer was showing a bunch of his stuff earlier in the year. And all of the friends who went for the first time to see a film by him with me, they all said similar things like, I'm not quite sure if I followed everything, but I know that was good, and I liked how quiet it was, and I'm interested in more.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. We have people we made. Yes.
No, I think it is a case we made for Silence. That sounds strange, but I mean, I think Mad Max is a movie that, by dialing down the amount of spoken dialogue, it does qualify as a quiet, silent, that's a
non-verbal.
A intriguingly sound designed movie.
Which I kind of feel like I want to throw in Charlotte Rampling's performance in 45 Years. As strong as the dialogue in that film is, so much of what she's giving in that movie is these glances and these looks and these pauses. And you know, you get so much sort of emotional honesty out of her, and you learn so much about this woman and what she's thinking that she doesn't have to talk about it all.
Yeah, in fact, when I saw 45 Years, I thought, if this had been a play, it would have been a bad play. It has to be a movie because the dialogue doesn't mean that much. And, you know, play dialogue really has to mean... I mean, very few playwrights have gotten away with dialogue that doesn't necessarily mean much but still be powerful. But 45 Years, you don't remember things people said. You remember tension in a room and who's looking at who and who's trying to get somebody's attention and who's, you know, accepted something but then worried. And then it all accumulates to that awesome last scene where there's... A roar around her, and she is just horrified. Mm. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, that's so.
And her LAFCA acceptance video was the best because she says, "I am the chosen one."
It was awkwardly paused. It was odd.
There have been many this year, but I have been chosen.
Unfortunately for your listeners, all of my responses to this last question have been nonverbal. So.
But you were conveying a great deal of strength.
I mean that movie's, you know, very delicate. That performance is very nuanced and subtle, and yet, like for me, I think, I mean, a big part of my bias as a critic, and it doesn't have to apply to every film, but like I just love screenplay. I love, you know, and I love when it's dense and written and Chayefsky, and you know, it's like the I don't know. I think we oversell how great it was in the sense of like not every screenplay was that great, but it's like it definitely has been kind of a slide in the other direction.
We're reaching peak improvisation, I feel like. The idea that comedies now have to be almost entirely improvised, and I had to review like the re-release of Metropolitan this year, and I remember sometimes a movie is totally written and you know it's totally written and it sounds totally written, but it's beautiful to hear, like people reciting dialogue that was meant to be said that way.
I'm not anti-words. I'd just like to put that out there. I think my problem with it's less, I like a very rich, I mean, I love 1930s screwball, so how can I not love, you know, very fast, you know, very furious dialogue? I think my main problem are certain kind of trends in contemporary screenwriting, you know, where there's certain kind of, there's a lot of explanation that goes on in American cinema where people are explaining how they feel a lot. And then you just think, I always think, you know, the director, writer has been through a lot of therapy and they believe that's how you tell a character, is that everyone's constantly...
Or written a lot for TV.
Or written a lot for television, and that's what I was going to say. I do think some of this is really, you know, kind of leaked over from television where, you know, it's much more of a writer's medium and has historically been, not so much anymore. But, you know, how many television shows can you, you know, basically, you know, have running and you're like in the other room and you can still follow what's going on?
Absolutely.
So
laundry folders, my wife calls it.
Radio with pictures.
Exactly. For me, it's a radio play. I do a lot of housework while watching, listening to television. So for me, it's not so much, I love great screenplays. I don't think we have enough of them, but I do. But it's more a certain kind of tendencies in screenwriting to over-explain. We'll see a lot of that in Sundance, of course, where it's basically young filmmakers in particular are really terrible. And Americans just do a lot of freaking explaining constantly, you know?
Yeah, you can write a scene where a woman puts her gloves on that tells you 10 things about that character, but most American movies will just have her tell some post about them, you know.
I mean, narration is just rampant now. The movie starts and a main character is telling you everything as they're showing it to you, and you're just like, oh, please stop. Maybe you did this narration because you had a problem movie and you needed to, and you felt like you needed to explain something, but narration needs to go away.
A character putting her gloves on is screenwriting too. I mean, that's
sure,
part of
sure,
that.
Sure.
Oh yeah, no question.
I was just talking about dialogue.
Dialogue.
Yeah. But and so I mean,
you were talking about Chayefsky, so I just thought
right. No, and obviously, I mean, like when it's dense and it's fast and furious, and when it's Armando Iannucci is probably my favorite example of someone working today who does this.
Sure.
You know, it's like the but there is definitely so yes. I mean, I like movies too where they give you room to breathe and respond and make it. To personalize the movie, ultimately, that's sort of what the opportunity of silence is, you know, or music, or you know, kind
you
of
think, or actually try to figure out stuff yourself without someone explaining it to
did
you.
Any
well,
of y'all
there was a movie I love this year that was very written, and but because it had an element of like of avant-gardeness to it. I thought it was balanced. That was Experimenter. I thought Experimenter
was a
lot of fabulous. Dialogue. I mean, in fact, the talking was one of the revelations of the movie.
Sure.
But a fun visual sense, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. So it had a fun visual sense, but it just had these wonderful scenes of people talking.
And on the same token, I loved The Tribe. That was on my top five this year. And there's not a word in it, you know. And it's
There are words in it.
Well, there are, but they're in Ukrainian Sign Language that is not being subtitled for you, you know.
I wasn't.
Not a fan.
I was not. Yeah.
Not a fan.
I can't get with Jim.
Me too. Yeah, I'm in the Dave White corner.
I think we might actually be in the majority here because
I'm in the Alonzo.
Two, right?
I'm with the Alonzo.
Fine.
I'm not care for it.
Yeah. I'm excited again by a movie like that in the way that a movie like Room, which I found more successful, excites me. Just that, like, you know, people are trying things, you know, that are different and new. But the idea that it all builds up to that. That kind of aggression, and you know, it's like the there were a lot of things in that movie. It's been a year and a half since I've seen it, so it's rusty, but it's like that rubbed me.
Well, that's one of the few movies that I saw three times because I saw it for a jury last year for in 2014 for AFI, and then I screened it twice for my class this year. I think it holds up. I think it's really powerful, and I always am finding new facets to it.
Yeah. I loved it more as a I'm a big. Crime genre person, and I think it just as a crime movie, I loved it. That's my primary like.
I thought it was really physically aggressive, which I always respond to, and that was when I saw it. When I saw it at CineFamily, I walked out of it feeling like, like I've just been punched over and over again.
Yeah,
look at my camera move.
And and then the more I thought about it, I just thought.
There's a lot of static wide shots in that movie.
I think I just watched exploitation.
But it is a movie you notice. I mean, like, whether it's static or it's moving, you do notice
it. Such showboating.
But really, magnetic showboating.
You're a filmmaker in
Ukraine.
I mean, how are you going to put yourself on the map? And in a way, like, part of that is just, you know, doing something really different and really kind of like...
Sergei Lorenz... How do you say
his name?
I'm talking about... okay, never mind. Just edit that out.
Speaking of camera to tell story, what did you... Robert, you were a Son of Saul fan, right?
Oh, I think Son of Saul is very powerful.
Yeah,
I totally get why.
I still haven't seen it.
Son of Saul for me is that was the movie that just is the discovery of the year for me. And I understand that it, you know, divides a lot of people. I understand there are a lot of people who can't bring themselves to watch it. All of those things I think are valid. But I think it's like the it's interesting that a movie has I remember taking a class on Holocaust cinema in college and kind of like...
Oh, that must have been fun.
I was going to say, whoa, wow. At 8 a.m., I hope.
I feel like there was a period in which I kind of gorged on the subject, and it's such a weird, you know, thing to do. But
it's a weird verb to use, that's all I'm going
to say. I mean, certainly the images that, like, you know, had more than my fill of, you know, and it's like the... And you're seeing it done well, and you're seeing it done poorly, and you're seeing it done, you know, for sentimental and, you know, kind of like melodramatic effect. And, you know, here's a movie that seems to be aware of all of the, you know, the intellectual arguments against, you know, making films about the Holocaust. I know that it can. I don't know if you've come around at all, but I know
No, I hate it just as much, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you'll have an interesting response, no doubt. But it's like, this is a movie that I felt like really, you know, kind of like achieved something that I had never experienced in any of those other films, which was really putting me into that situation, which is... You know, something that you could question whether that's even, you know, an experience any of us want or should have. But it's like, in terms of the farther we get from it, I think, you know, I understand that there's kind of a need, I think, to kind of like bring a new generation or bring audiences in general into, you know, into.
It's made for the virtual audience. I mean, the audience is in the virtual experience and. Yeah,
I mean,
it's extreme cinema.
Yeah, it is.
Because no, go ahead.
I hate the movie. I don't really want to talk about it. Honestly, I just think it's. I think it's a fraud. I think it's. I thought it was awful. I mean,
wow.
I was so offended by it, so deeply offended by
really?
It. But I am in such a profound minority. It's almost like not even. I mean, it hasn't
I
actually been that. It hasn't been that controversial. Most people really like it. It's been nominated for an Oscar.
Well,
it's gonna win. You know,
because my thing, I feel like at this point you've got to give me something that I have not seen in a Holocaust movie before. If you're going to make a Holocaust movie, what I thought was interesting about this technique was this notion that we're going in knowing what we know about the camps and about what happened there, and this is a movie that says, you know what, I'm not even going to show them to you because you know what's happening just off screen. On both sides, you know everything that's going around him. It is in a way more effective if in the way that like effective horror movies don't show you the monster and you have to think about it yourself. For me, the horror that was going on just off camera was so vivid and so inescapable that it was more horrifying to me than if you were just shoving your lens right into it. And so I spent the whole movie kind of like, yeah, like you were saying, it is a sort of this sort of virtual experience where the movie's not telling you what's there, but you know, you know, and maybe that's dishonest for like young people who don't know or whatever. But for me, for whatever experience I have of other Holocaust movies or reading about the Holocaust or whatever, I was filling in those blanks, and those blanks are horrifying. And I thought that was an effective way to tell that story.
They are, but, you know, what's it's interesting that it does rely on kind of the body of history beyond the movie to a certain extent. But I do think that, I mean, I've seen that movie at least 3 times in parts and whatever, because, I mean, it's like I'm still kind of coming to terms with it and understanding how it's done and, you know, the and reconciling parts of it. You know, it's like we don't always know what the character, even though you're kind of like, you're identifying with him, you can't always relate to what he's going through.
And he's an unreliable narrator. Yeah.
And he's doing these things that are kind of, you know, against his own survival in a way that's part of the point, that he's found this, you know, this thing that is somehow more important to him than surviving the burial. But to me, the thing that's interesting is even if you know nothing, part of that subjectivity is being in an environment where it's this barrage of languages and it's this confusion and it's this fear that from any moment in any, you know, corner, it could be the end. It's, you know, it's like the, it's been said, but I think it's important, you know, to this film that, like, you know, almost every other Holocaust movie that we've ever seen are survival stories. And obviously not for all the characters, but are, you know, they're kind of handed down testimony from survivors. And there's this kind of optimism there. And this is not a survivor story. And the majority of those who were sent to camps were not survivors. And it's like, you know, how do you deal with the reality of the death, you know, it's like, to me that confusion is important. It's part of what the movie got across for me, this idea that, you know, he's kind of navigating between the fact that there are these little areas, these blind spots where, you know, people aren't pointing a gun at him at all times, and the fact that at any moment, a gun could be pointed at him any time, you know, and it's like the, and that just gave me a sense of identification with that scenario that I've never confronted before, you know, and it's like, and that is the event of the past century that we have to kind of like process in some way, you know, and it's like as mankind, I don't know, I feel like I'm getting a little hoity-toity or something, but it's, that's not the word either. You know, it's like the, there will, even if the stories are not all individual, there can never be enough movies about the Holocaust, I think. And the fact that this one does it in a way that, you know, just kind of led me to identify with it in that level, you know, for me was a profound experience.
We are both hoity and toity on this podcast, so you must never be afraid of being hoity toity.
I will say, if that was it, Manola, I'm in the same boat with The Look of Silence. In terms of everybody else loves that movie, and I was not.
What the hell is that?
The Josh Oppenheimer.
Yeah, because I hated the first one. Sorry.
Okay, well then you won't like this one either. My deal with The Look of Silence was,
he's a very nice man though.
It felt to me like a DVD extra from the other one. And I know the story that he started on this one, and then he went off and made the other one, and then he came back and finished this one. This to me felt so like a weak tea version of what he'd already kind of covered in the first movie, and I didn't totally love the first movie either, that I was not taken by it. It's like a 90 plus on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's one of the most impossible assignments I've ever had, to be like the first review of that movie in the world.
I reviewed it at Venice. I reviewed it.
The actor killing? Was it Telluride? And it's like, I mean, I don't know if I was literally, but it's like as a trade, you're at the film festival where it comes out, and you're just, and the movie's been refined since then. I haven't seen this kind of new edit, but it's like, it's a fascinating project that, that for me is, they've never kind of really figured it out. You know, it's like, there's still a lot of editing and work and structuring. I mean, there's too much in that movie.
Yeah, there's pieces, but it doesn't.
And of course, like, you know, if you're talking just about, this is a documentary problem in general, if you're talking about the subject matter, it's, you know, it's important, you know, as maybe, like, that wasn't my defense of Son of Saul, by the way, but it is like a fallback for a lot of documentaries that, like, you know, the, like, whether it's done well or not doesn't matter because we're so in the camp of.
Yeah, like when Gasland got an Oscar nomination, it's like, okay, yes, fracking is important, but this is not a very good movie.
Well, movie this year is kind of like encountering that. You know, I haven't seen it, but the Hunting Ground.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like the like, no one's gonna take a stand saying that, you know, rape on college campuses, you know,
there should be more of them, you know.
Subject, right.
Yeah, but the question remains, like, has he tackled that? And I think in The Act of Killing, he just hasn't solved his own assignment.
Well, The Act of Killing was a movie that, like, I mean, I was just kind of mesmerized by it, but at the same time, I was being driven toward these homicidal impulses that I had never been as strong in any other movie that I've gotten before, and I thought, I don't know if this is a good thing for me to. So, but then The Look of Silence came around, I felt more engaged in the movie as it maybe contemplate a situation in that country. Like, I thought about the situation in the country much more forcefully than The Act of Killing. The Act of Killing was just a bizarre film that, you know, you could see why somebody would hate it. You could see why somebody would find it, you know, interesting. But I just remember thinking, like, I want to kill all these people. and the Look of Silence, you know, because it set up a situation that mitigates that desire, because you're with this guy as he interviews these people, and you want him to get what he needs out of the situation, so you are forced to think about everything.
I think if I had not seen The Act of Killing and had just seen The Look of Silence cold, I might have responded to it more. Yeah. But there's no escaping that.
It's a more
movie.
Traditional documentary, for sure. You know, it's like I saw another movie at IDFA, which is this documentary festival in Amsterdam, and it's always interesting there because they invite documentaries that aren't always strong, but always are about these kind of big issues. And so in a day, you can try and gorge yourself on, you know, genocide and eco disasters and, you know, kind of like
good times.
Like, you know, all of the, but around each film, they will host kind of like the filmmaker or experts and have these, I mean, they want to be kind of like a venue where these discussions around these issues can take place. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there I saw a movie called Snow Monkey this year that takes place in Afghanistan that, George Gittos, I think, is the artist filmmaker's name, has gone and kind of like connected with some of these kind of like street urchin orphans who are running around in Afghanistan who, if let, could grow up to be Taliban, could grow up to be criminal, gang, whatever. And he engages them in making a film project in which he has to kind of like work with the Taliban to do it. And there are a lot of these kind of strange connections to active killing in the sense of, your own judgment on just the morality, the ethics of what's going on is very, very complex. And yet, the motive of both him and Joshua Oppenheimer, they want to kind of expose the problems of these situations, and they want to kind of advance the dialogue, and they want to, rectify bigger problems than they could possibly themselves do. But
how much do you credence, though, do you give to, intentionality? I mean, the thing is, I understand that, Oppenheimer, I understand what he was trying to do, I think, but what I saw on screen just,
it never seemed to match. Like, the movie that he kept saying that he was making didn't seem to be the movie that he was making.
Was watching. I don't. I try not to read a lot of stuff before I see a movie, because I just don't want to know, what were they trying to do? Because then it turns in, what was your intention? Well, I was trying to do that. So.
There's more match with Look of Silence to me, but uh-huh. When you read about what he says about it and the making of it and the movie that you see, I think there's more of a match there. Amy, to me, is the documentary leader. I thought Amy was
really great.
Astonishing.
I actually find myself... I dislike that movie, and I don't seem to find anyone else who feels the same way.
I know a person who hates that movie.
Yeah.
And it was
the
just... It's not that... It was just like, I don't understand why that movie is... At least every other shot in that movie is slow motion. I don't understand why that movie is as long as it is.
But...
The biggest visual cliche that we now have to live with is the slow motion. It's every single movie now has a slow motion. Mm-hmm. But
this movie is 50% slow motion, and maybe it's
They've only got so much footage, and they've got people have to talk over it.
That wasn't slow motion to begin with. I think that's different than making something slow motion to start out with. I think his use of archival footage and his manipulation of it is some of the most intricate and amazing and emotional I've ever seen.
It's clearly deliberate. I mean, but for me, it's am not a big follower of pop music. Embarrassingly don't know a lot about Amy Winehouse, and I didn't come out of that really having been impacted the way that I think people who did and had a relationship with her as an artist.
I didn't really know that much of her stuff,
either.
And I
had a full-on, I was bereft when she died.
But just, I think you watch that arc of where she starts and where she winds up, and it's just kind of undeniably heartbreaking. And I like the way that they incorporate the interviews in that movie without it just being talking head. Because believe me, at the film festival, I see a lot of that stuff.
And then he recorded most of these interviews in dark rooms with no camera with these people, so that they would actually talk freely and not feel like they had to perform for a camera. So
right.
He got more interesting interviews from them to begin with, and then he just. He looked at the movie as an investigation, and I think that right there was, there's no preconceived notion in this movie except he just wanted to find out what he thought happened to her. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of documentaries you see now, especially ones about, famous people, there is the Miss Simone, the Nina Simone documentary, which is good, but I mean, you just saw at every moment, the goal was to position in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And I think Amy just never has that quality because he came to it not knowing anything about her. And I think that comes through, and it makes you look at things the fact that he has lyrics printed on the screen, which is, sounds cheesy, but it actually is so moving when you see these lyrics on the screen, printed. It's he somehow makes that moving.
I like Amy quite a bit, but my favorite documentary is In Jackson Heights.
Yeah, that one too.
Me too.
Because. We
saw it together.
We did see it together. There were two of us in the room. It's funny. We put Belfast, Maine on a VHS tape.
It aired on
PBS in 1999 or 2000 or whenever that was.
I went down to the Grand Fourplex.
And we were just about to move here, or we had just moved here. I don't know. But the that VHS tape sat in the closet until the week that I saw in Jackson Heights.
Okay.
Oh. I just never got around to sitting down for a 4-hour movie about a little town in Maine. And then I sat down and watched it. And then I saw in Jackson Heights, and I was like, oh, this is the same thing happening. I just feel like when he goes to a strip club, that's fun. When he goes to a boxing gym, that's fun. When he goes to Neiman Marcus, that's really fun. But when he goes to a town and there's not a confined space and there's all this room to roam and all these people who have entirely different lives, you know, in this place, I feel like he gets closer to showing us how people really live their lives and interact with each other and the forces that are working against them.
Well, yeah, I mean, to
as
me,
well,
like, yeah,
and that's what really, yeah,
standing up and talking about who you are. I mean, yeah, that is a movie about standing up and talking about who you are. I don't think Belfast is more about watching people do things like shuck, you know, oysters and things like whatever that, you know, the, all those shots of like people working. You don't see people working in Jackson Heights. You see them talking about who they are,
yeah,
celebrating.
Yeah.
And I think those
coming
together as community. That's what that movie clearly what interested him. And that's what makes Jackson Heights special.
I mean, I think it's really about, these are a lot of different populations and they're like little cells. I don't mean it in prison, but little cells.
Sure.
So, and mm-hmm. that he goes and, you know, here's like Muslims and we're at a Jewish center and mm-hmm. now we're at a, you know, gay, lesbian, you know, and it's
and
like,
it's the same building.
It's
right. Yeah,
that's the best part. Yeah.
But you know, there's living and then there's like, at a certain point, if your life is threatened, you have to get up and stand up for yourself. And I think that's the great thing about In Jackson Heights is it has all those scenes of people doing that.
Why does he get no love from the Academy? What is up with
that? I'll tell you. Well, I have an Frederick Wiseman. I have an anecdote that might.
No.
It's a 3-hour
movie. Leonardo DiCaprio is like, I must die.
I was on the doc jury one year for the Spirit Awards, and
are you telling tales out of school?
I'm not naming names.
Okay, all right.
And there was, he's prolific. There was some Wiseman doc that year. I forget which one. And I remember liking it and championing it. And at least one, if not both, of the actual documentarians on the jury hate him. And it wasn't clear if it was a personal thing or a stylistic thing. But
that's
they
the thing
were
I'm so
just,
excited to know.
Personally not liked.
He
I
was
just
spot. Well, who do you think?
I guess the Academy of Care.
That's
why?
Who votes. Yeah, doc filmmakers vote
know,
for best documentary. That's
why.
I'm jealous.
Is he?
I had the same experience. It wasn't about that.
You can take breaks.
But it wasn't about. I had a similar experience being on a doc jury for that awards and a Wiseman movie being in contention and me going, everybody, you have to watch this and not everybody getting into it. And then like finding out later that when people finally watched it after it was too late, they were like, oh yeah, it was really good. And I'm like, oh. You know, so it's, you know,
I want to know if he's just a really mean guy.
No, it's not mean.
Apparently,
Paris.
I mean,
no,
you guys must have.
No, I think he's a gregarious guy.
Oh, is he?
I think the thing is he likes to like, he's really into like making jokes and being like, not.
Then what's hateable
serious,
about that?
Like in person,
they're much more hateable documentary filmmakers.
So many.
I mean, it's like and they get plenty of Oscar love. So it's like the. I mean, it's
and also just being an asshole has never stopped anyone from winning an Oscar, as we know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Say that
yeah. We'll bleep you out. Not a big deal.
Okay,
did any of y'all see, this is not about documentaries, did any of you guys see Horse Money?
No.
No?
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
I thought it was long.
Yeah.
Unduly, unnecessarily cryptic.
Okay.
Boring. At times, but at times interesting. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
So Adam Sandler?
Pedro Costa's Ridiculous Six.
He's sometimes interesting, sometimes less interesting.
Okay.
You know, I have this thing about movies, it seemed to me that they only really live on the festival circuit. They can't exist outside of the kind of hot house atmosphere of a festival.
Right.
And at times you start to feel they are made for festivals.
I think that that's true. I mean,
which is not necessarily a bad thing, because it, you know, festivals have become a kind of another world.
But
onto
isn't
themselves.
The Assassin that? I mean, isn't The Assassin a movie made to premiere at the Cannes
not.
Film Festival?
Absolutely not. I
and
think
then,
that's a really, I think that that is a really underselling of Po Cha Chen, who I think is truly one of the great filmmakers working.
But I mean,
no,
I,
absolutely.
But
not.
I think that, like, I mean, it's just like here we live in a country where we are confronted with a commercial cinema, an industrial cinema that has to make money. And in other countries and in other, you know, in other funding organizations and things like that, it's not about hoping that this is one in 10 films that, you know, is the blockbuster or that, you know, makes its money back. It's like, and I think Cannes is, you know, to the world now, what, you know, the salons were, you know, kind of for painters once upon a time, where it's like, it is about kind of putting a certain kind of artist's work up on the screen cold, without context, without any kind of, you know, anything other than, you know, the artist's name is known and their past work is familiar, if they're not a new discovery, you know, and it's like, and then, you know, seeing how it plays in that environment, and then the rest is gravy. It's not that it's made for just the people in that room,
mm-hmm.
but it is kind of made with that screen in that Palais in mind and that audience first, and it's like the rest of the world can take or leave it, you know, and it's like,
I just think that's so underselling Po Cha Chen, who I truly believe is one of the great filmmakers. I just feel like that. I don't think that Pedro Costa is. I think that there are, I think one of the problems also we're talking about is that, like in the United States, for instance, that the market for foreign language films and particularly more rarefied films, I mean, is really, really difficult, you know, theatrically speaking.
Yeah, this film played in Los Angeles one night.
Exactly. And so,
yeah,
I mean, and it's really,
you know,
Horseman.
Yeah, one night.
So, I mean, what's interesting to me is, like, I don't think if La Ventura opened now, it would get distributed, it would be picked up for 1 week and it'd be on, you know,
Cinema
streaming.
Guild would have it.
Exactly. You know, that part of this is, like, I think the problem, I should be more nuanced when I'm talking about festival films. I think that there are certain movies that, for me, feel like they're just made for a certain group of people. I just actually don't believe that about Ho Chi Minh. I really just don't. I think that that's never been part of, you know, he's been making movies for quite some time. I think that there's a kind of, I just feel like with Horse Money, that pleases maybe three people, and that's
great.
Well,
it's a form of solipsism. It's almost like the filmmakers are making it for themselves, and it almost doesn't matter.
I don't know if they're just making it for themselves, but I do feel that it's too, I feel like they're movies that somehow feel like they're being made to be as cryptic as possible in a way, because people are afraid of being obvious in a strange way. I know that sounds kind of strange.
Yeah.
But it's just like the people are afraid of narrative almost sometimes, it feels like. And so you can't have anything too obvious.
This certainly
is not obvious.
An anti-narrative film almost. Yeah.
And I'm like, you know me.
Yeah,
no. I'm
a guard
woman.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know?
That's why I Matt Severson and I went to see it. And you're right, it is cryptic, and
but not in an interesting way.
At the same time, I will say, I loved the experience of watching
it.
Because I feel like I was being drawn into this
web of
intrigue, of darkness. This very singular place of darkness and regret and literal darkness, because it's sort of encroaching on everyone.
It's
in
very,
every
very, very dark.
Frame. There's blackness surrounding everyone. And we walked out of the film and I said, "Did you understand everything that you just saw?" And he goes, "Nah." And I was like, "Me neither. It's okay though."
If you can answer that question, yes, it's probably not a very interesting movie.
Yeah,
and it's right. And it's like even the
who's the woman in the gold mask?
But I would say I don't mind not understanding movies.
Yeah, that's
it's like when I first saw Mulholland Drive, I wasn't
perfect
quite
example.
Sure what was going on. I understood most of it, I saw it, but I was like, well, what in the world was going on there? And then I saw it again, I'm like, oh, I get it, you know. But it's interesting because I don't mind not understanding a movie. And I think that's part of our training.
Sure.
That's part of it. And so I'm happy to go along with it.
movies are Rorschach tests to an, extent as well.
Well, I don't feel threatened by it because I'm a smart person. I'm not getting it. That's okay. I'll go back and try it again.
And that leads into your thing about things being over-explained. Like the example that I always cite, just because it's the thing of... It's not even that movies are being cryptic. It's just that movies that don't give you the credit for getting the visual information, so they have to also tell it to you.
Right.
Like, Ron Howard does this a lot.
Yeah.
Like, he'll show you something that's happening, and then in case you were in the bathroom, a character will then tell another character about the whole thing.
I'm always in the bathroom, though, so I'm okay with Ron Howard doing that.
You know, the worst for me was, remember Road to Perdition?
Oh yeah,
that mob movie. So there's a scene where Sam Mendes. I know it's not Ron Howard, but I'm just saying this is the example I always remember because it just drove me up the wall. Like, Paul Newman is the big mob boss and he's sitting at the piano. Tom Hanks, who is like his main gunsel, sort of sits down next to him and they start duetting. Over on the side, we see Paul Newman's son Daniel Craig glowering at them. That tells you everything you need to know. And then somebody walks up to somebody else and says, he's always resented him for being more of the son than he ever blah, blah, blah. I'm like, shut up, movie! I know this already!
I love those movies where, like, it's about, you know, there's a scene with a couple, and they keep saying, Robert, what do you think? Why, Manola? You know, like, because I know at home, I just call my, I'm constantly saying my husband's name.
So Lou.
There are a lot of movies where you have to wait until the credits, as a critic, to even identify the names of the...
Those are usually in Europe, though, I think.
Right? Who was Solange? Well, all right. We're going to let you guys go because this has been. I could do this.
So many more.
I could do this. I could do this all night, but I feel like I'm taking up your time. Well, so real quick, just maybe throw out some titles of movies that you love this year that not enough people saw
mentioned. Well, I mentioned one. So I'm done. Experimenter. I feel like Experimenter.
Tangerine.
That you should all.
Tangerine.
Yeah.
Another one of the best movies of the year.
Dave mocks me for putting this in my top 10, but I really loved Grandma, and I thought that had a lot going for it. And in addition to the performances, which were great, especially Sam Elliott, who got to play something that wasn't Sam Elliott.
71, which nobody didn't
see it. I need to.
Well, it's part of that falls in that weird kind of what year was it?
For us, it's 1 year, for most mortals, it was something else, right? Chirac, I think, is a movie that people should see. I would also say
Tiona Paris.
Timbuktu is another movie that people should check out.
Yes.
That may not be
I need
obvious.
To see that. Yeah,
it's sitting by the television.
And
right now.
White God, a movie.
Yes.
And The Wolf Pack. You know, it's just a little theme going.
Right.
So,
really? Because I heard real mixed about that one. You like
The Wolf
Pack?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting. And,
okay.
You know, it's about people who love movies.
Yeah.
And
it's got one element to it that
frighteningly live through the movie.
That you question. There's one element that you question in terms of the director did, but they are fascinating characters.
And in terms of documentary ethics, it's certainly an interesting object in terms of a documentary and being involved in people's lives in an interesting, perhaps troublesome way. So.
I had to review a lot of horror movies. What I do is I see a lot of horror movies, and I had to say, like, It Follows was the most interesting horror film I saw this year. So it was something that hit, so people probably have seen it, but I mean, I'm just saying it's a very, very interesting horror
movie. I really like that one.
I love Tangerine. Duke of Burgundy is another one of those movies that kind of falls into what year was it, but for me, I guess if it was released in the States this past year, you know, it's definitely one of my favorites. That's certainly a little... kind of like you'd have to go digging to find a copy of it, but it's worth it.
Diary of a Teenage Girl, too.
Oh my gosh, we didn't talk about that.
Which
oh.
is really, that is a movie that really should have had more, when I saw that movie, I thought, oh, this will be a huge indie summer movie, and then it will be a big talk about it, and I just seem to not catch on.
It died on the vine.
So sad.
I think I would have liked it more if I'd not read the book. I think reading the book... elevated my expectations too much because it's
Do
so great.
Do you think
great.
It got lost in the confusion of Paper Towns and Me and Earl and the Dying Girl?
No.
Well, even that movie didn't do
well, there was an article about how...
What I mean is, when those things all come out at once and people
are
like, I don't know what this
that
is.
Title,
is it
yeah.
the
yeah.
same thing.
The title
you know?
Is very like, you might assume something from that title.
There was an article about how older skewing indies were actually doing better this year, like Grandma and some other ones. And the younger ones like Me and Earl and
Woman in Gold.
Woman in Gold. You know, which speaks to who's going to movies, I think, unfortunately.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Who's going, the theatrical experience.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I often feel very young when I go into a movie theater. Right.
I know this was last year for Cannes, but Clouds of Sils Maria.
Oh, yeah.
So great. What's a 2016 movie that you guys have already seen at festivals that you think people should keep an eye out for?
Because I do my top 10 list a little differently, because I haven't seen Creed, I haven't seen Concussion. You know, those movies have black people in it, and the French, you know, aren't the first in line to import those movies. But it's like, that's probably not the right way to interpret it. But it's like,
it is one way to interpret it.
I don't know that Spotlight, or, you know, I don't know if Spotlight's coming there anytime soon either, which, you know, is one of my favorite movies of the year. But
is that the kind of thing where if it wins Best Picture, it will, and then if it doesn't, it won't, or does that matter?
I don't. I mean, it'll probably eventually find its way there.
Why not Spotlight? I mean, there's certainly a lot of Catholics in France.
No kidding.
But it's a very kind of like. American story, you know, but obviously it had repercussions.
Yeah.
Internationally.
I haven't kept up. Maybe it has maybe it's been dated yet, but like, you know, it was nowhere on the calendar, you know, when I came for the holidays. But there is a movie that I saw on the festivals last year called Above and Below. That's a documentary. It's actually a student film that was sort of shot out here in the desert. You know, this guy who's Swiss found five individuals who are kind of like living off the grid, one kind of like in a bunker out by the Salton Sea, you know, a couple in the tunnels beneath Las Vegas.
The Salton Sea.
It
smells bad out there. How do you live out there?
So the idea is these people who kind of, there's one who kind of came back from Afghanistan and is like part of this desert kind of Mars mission, like preparing to be the first manned, it's just more like some sort of course or practice you do. You don't really get to be sent there, but like, why do these people kind of recuse themselves from society? And it's a movie that has lots of silence. It's got a certain amount of manipulation. It's not a strict documentary in terms of, you know, the way it's been. There are like, you know, crane shots and things like this that are not cinema verite techniques. And to me, it's just one of the most gorgeous philosophical and kind of ruminative movies I saw all last year with an amazing soundtrack, but that got picked up by Oscilloscope and will come out sometime.
Oh, great.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Cool.
Thank you for the tip.
Manola?
I don't remember anything.
Robert?
I don't think I can come up with anything either.
I would throw out De Palma. The Brian De Palma documentary.
The No Bombax.
Yeah, and Jake Paltrow.
Right.
I'm not a giant fan of De Palma's work. I love some and I'm indifferent to others, and it shouldn't work because it is one stationary. I mean, every time they cut back to De Palma, it's the exact same shot. Like, that camera has never moved. Mm-hmm. But they intercut the scenes from his films that he's referring to and from other films that he's referring to in such a way that's so dynamic, and just, you want it to be a series where they do this with a bunch of different directors, mm-hmm, who are really articulate about their own work and about why they made certain choices. And, you know, it got me very excited. It made me want to see films of his that I either have never seen or maybe didn't get the first time. But I was fascinated from start to finish. Such a great kind of movie nerd movie. About
great archival. So I keep coming back to this one clip of Steven Spielberg. It's a home video of Steven Spielberg holding a cinder block sized cell phone and calling Brian De Palma from his car.
Yes.
I mean, it's incredible. Like and it's the third of three great Noah Baumbach movies that kind of
found
their way into
the world last year. He had quite a year. I didn't love While We're Young or Mistress America enough to put them on my top 10 list, but I enjoyed them both very much.
Really,
and I think they had a lot. They had a lot going on.
America was
such a gift.
She's dynamite.
Such a gift to us.
Yeah, really. I'm real curious to see how she's going to be in the Todd Solondz movie now.
And I love While We're Young. I put that on my top 10 last year. I probably am the only person who put it on a top 10 list any year. But it's like that movie to me is kind of a throwback to a certain kind of, you know, scripted comedy that we don't get anymore. And it has that thing that Baumbach does of like laser insight into certain things about a certain class and a certain age and a certain kind of human being that no other director seems to put their finger on.
Yeah. And once that line is said, he's moved on to the next line, and there's no, like, you know, it's a swirl of observations and jokes and character eccentricities, and you just kind of love being a part of it. It's like being at a party.
Yeah, the scene where Greta Gerwig does her like presentation is one of the best scenes of the year, no question. Like that and in a year where I think maybe a lot of that's what you were saying about improvisation. The comedy, this is not a strong year for comedy, but I would say Mistress America and Spy had some of the sharpest wordplay I've seen all year.
Spy was great because like you know that like. He went to the movie though with a fully thought out and really funny story idea and character development and a really great spy plot. I mean, those things are all in place, and when those are all in place, then you can do things like have actors like make up stuff on the set that's hilarious.
Sure.
And work. I mean, so Spy had so many things going for it before he implemented that rule, and I think that's what's missing sometimes from these movies. They just feel like, we'll just start shooting and everyone will be fine.
Yeah, like, you create that exoskeleton first and then go nuts, yeah.
And Adam McKay is doing something different now with The Big Short where he's actually using that technique in adapting an incredibly difficult to understand financial crisis. He used that same technique.
And adapting, and literally adapting a book, too.
Oh, yeah, I like what he's doing with it. I'll watch whatever
he does.
That
was one of the more delightful surprises. Yeah. Like, what? That works? I don't understand.
Well, you guys, this is a joy every year. We love having y'all here. And thank you so much for coming in. So real quick, where can people find you online? Manola, what are you on Twitter?
It's Manola Dargis on Twitter, I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
You know, just don't be mean because I'll mute you.
Make sure you spell it right. Yeah.
Manoladargis. Robert, you are at RAABLE.
That is correct.
RAABELE.
Yeah, because I use my middle initial A.
And Peter is at Ask DeBruge, AskDeBruge. I will put all these on the Facebook page.
And I'm not tweeting nearly enough. There's a New Year's resolution just to sort of like.
I'll start asking you questions.
Oh, please.
Yeah. Sure.
Really? A whole class of Holocaust movies?
DeBruge answers. Just change it to DeBruge answers.
That's awesome. Right. I like that. That's good. That's really good.
My usual end
Thank
of show
you to
thing.
Blue for the theme music.
That's right.
Listen to the other podcasts that we tell you about every week.
Like us on Facebook, leave us a review on iTunes, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We will catch up with your letters starting next week, including top 10 lists and such. Although, actually, we'll be doing that in 2 weeks because next week.
That's right.
I'll be at Sundance and Dave will not. So
not only will that be happening, you'll be doing Linoleum Knife.
With Bibbs from Park
in
City.
Sundance. I will be doing B-Movies podcast with Whitney.
Here in L.A.
Here. Then the next week, we'll catch up on your letters, including this lovely,
handwritten,
hand-typed
letter.
Hand-typed letter.
That dates from October, because it's for the it's for the 5th anniversary show. It is from excellent friend of the show, Matt Severson, that we were just talking about,
where
he gives his top 15 films that have been released in the time that the show was running. We'll get to that. Also, the big news.
Oh, yes.
For 2 weeks show from now is we're going to lay that subscription on you, finally. It is being formalized. The final details. You are going to get things after you give us money.
And that's
going to be amazing for you.
The Linoleum Knife Patreon page, we're promising this.
We're doing Patreon. And
it's going to go live.
2 weeks.
On January 31st.
Yes.
So you heard it here first. We've been promising it for ages, but we are nailing ourselves to a deadline. January 31st, our Patreon page goes live, and your subscribers will get LKTV and all kinds of excellent stuff depending on what level you choose.
Items and extra content and, yeah.
So, read Manola at the New York Times, read Robert at the LA Times and The Wrap and various other places, read Peter and Variety, and thank you guys for coming, and we'll be back next week.
Happy New Year!
Man, man, thank you, man.
Thanks.
Monkey up. Goodbye.